Today, as the clock runs down on Theresa May's premiership, we discuss whether we're headed for Prime Minister Boris Johnson and what that would mean for the country. And a tribute to the wonderful children's author Judith Kerr. Patrick, a few months ago, you and I got into a car and then we stuck Brexit into the sat-nav. Since then, it's all gone a bit haywire.
Yep, I'm afraid the car broke down.
And that's why we're going to now do it again, because I'm not nervous about predicting that Theresa May's time has come. As we're recording, she is still clinging on, but if she doesn't quit today, on Friday the 24th of May, then she'll be gone very soon. And that means we need to do this again. We need a roadmap for the Conservative leadership and the keys to number 10, which could lead us to Boris Johnson.
I think that's the most likely outcome.
The Prime Minister's attempt to find agreement on Brexit has utterly failed. Yesterday, she was forced to cancel plans to publish her withdrawal agreement bill after it sent dozens of Tory MPs into a rage. Andrea Leadsom resigned as leader of the House of Commons, and the influential 1922 committee voted on whether to change party rules in order to force their leader out. Their secret ballot could be revealed today, unless Theresa May jumps before she is pushed.
I think she has personally come to the end of the road. Support for her within the party is dissipating to the extent of being almost non-existent.
I'm sad to say that I think the Prime Minister's political capital is now used up.
Their leaders are only there as long as they have the support of their colleagues, and that support, it appears, has been ebbing away.
This Prime Minister's days are numbered. But who comes next? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, are we headed for Prime Minister Boris Johnson? So, as we are recording, Theresa May is still in power, but she could be gone very soon. What can we expect today?
I think today she will be required to go onto the steps of Downing Street and say she is setting a date by which she will leave and that she's triggering a Conservative Party leadership election.
Patrick Winter is The Guardian's diplomatic editor and former political editor.
There are still some in Number 10 hold up there who are arguing that she's got one more throw of the dice. She could still get her withdrawal bill into the Commons and it might go better than it's being said at present. But I think if she pushes that too far, the men in grey suits, they are mainly men, on the 1922 executive will tell her that they have decided that there should be a further confidence motion put about her leadership and she will lose that.
Okay, so Theresa May goes, if not today, pretty soon. Who's in the running?
Well, it's more a question of who's not in the running, but various numbers have put us to the number who've actually put their name forward, either 17 to 24. But you've got to bear in mind, many of these people who are putting their name forward or potentially are not serious contenders to be Prime Minister. They're just trying to remind the Conservative Party that they exist.
Who are the favourites at the moment in this contest?
Well, the names that are being mentioned apart from Boris Johnson are the Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt.
Jeremy Hunt, who may have his eye on the top job.
He says here in this interview that he fancies a crack at succeeding Theresa May. Oh,
the Home Secretary, Savid Javid.
That the Home Secretary has revoked the British citizenship of Shamima Begum. I think that we've got to view this in light of a potentially imminent Tory leadership challenge. This is Sajid Javid trying to position...
Former Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab.
The Daily Telegraph focuses on the race to succeed Theresa May, reporting Dominic Raab's suggestion that the basic rate of income tax should be cut to 15p.
And after that, you're really... You could perm one from any 15.
Why did you say apart from Boris Johnson?
Because I think he is runaway, the front runner, and I think he's unstoppable.
You want the job? You want the job?
I mean, yes. I think if I'm going to go for it, of course I'm going to go for it.
So Tory MPs will choose their top two candidates, and they'll be put forward to a vote of around 100,000 party members who will pick our next Prime Minister. Is this a battle for the soul of the Conservative Party?
I think because of the timing for this contest, it's going to be an argument about Brexit and how to execute Brexit and finish the job that Theresa May was unable to finish, instead of being an argument about the Conservative Party, where it stands on issues such as social care or the economy. I think it will be quite a narrowly focused contest, so it won't be a battle for the soul of the Conservative Party. It'll be a battle about the form of Brexit that the UK takes.
Boris Johnson is really popular with members, but first he's got to persuade Westminster colleagues. And in Parliament, there is an anyone but Boris campaign, isn't there?
There is, or certainly there has been. Those who've been in close quarters with him, those who know him very well, have worked alongside him, a lot of them have doubts about his ability to be Prime Minister, whether he's got the kind of right organised mind, whether he has sufficiently fixed opinions. So there's a real doubt about him, but there's also an awareness that he is very popular with the membership and he's seen to be the person most likely to save their seat.
And is there a sign that people are starting to see that it could be inevitable? I mean, Michael Gove, for example, betrayed him because he thought he couldn't be leader in 2016.
Boris is an amazing and an impressive person, but I've realised in the last few days that Boris isn't capable of building that team and providing that unity. And so I came reluctantly, but firmly to the conclusion that I had to stand for the leadership of the Conservative Party.
But recently, it sounds as if he's had a bit of a change of heart.
Boris Johnson is a Conservative of flair, elan, distinction and intellect. I think Boris will make his case, and it's important that we give him the chance to make his case.
Very different words to the ones you used about him in 2016. I do want to ask you a couple of other things.
I've always had tremendous affection for him.
You've had time to reflect.
Yes, I think Michael Gove felt that episode where he allegedly stabbed Boris Johnson in the back or in the front was very much out of character. I think he felt uncomfortable with that. He likes to be liked, Michael Gove, and I think it was not something he feels proud of, and so I think he wants to reunify with the Johnson camp and reunify with the rest of the party, and that was an episode he regrets.
And meanwhile, there's a group that call themselves the One Nation Tories. They're the kind of centrist, the more liberal wing of the party. Are they coming on board as well?
I think they realise they haven't got a candidate has any chance of winning, so their best route to influence is to influence the kind of candidate that Boris Johnson will be. And although I think One Nation is a totally vacuous phrase and can mean anything to anyone, it is something that Boris Johnson can sign up to and bring over a couple of Remain-orientated MPs. And so, yes, I think there is a kind of rapprochement going on there.
And interestingly, Amber Rudd, who some may have said could have been a candidate herself, who once said that Boris Johnson was the...
Well, he's the life and soul of the party, but he's not the man you want driving you home at the end of the evening.
Seems to be changing her mind.
It's very clear to me that there's one individual that we can go forward and...
This week we've had Johnny Mercer suggest that Boris Johnson could be the centrist candidate.
That is Boris Johnson, I think. You know,
who could unite the party and country. I mean, who else has a chance to be up there?
I think Jeremy Hunt's working very hard. He's trying to, as Foreign Secretary, trying to use issues that might appeal to the Conservative Party membership, such as persecution of Christians.
We particularly want to look at the issue of Christian persecution, because the evidence is that 80% of all people who are suffering religious persecution are Christian.
But he's handicapped by the fact that he is a Remainer, and there's a general, although he's tried to convert as publicly as possible to the Leave cause, there's a general view that you need a true Leaver to lead the Conservative Party at this point. I think Matthew Hancock, who is the Health Secretary, is a potential, but only from the really back of the pack. And otherwise, it's Dominic Raab, who is a truer Eurosceptic and a thoroughbred Eurosceptic.
A I do think we are being bullied. I do think we are being subject to what is pretty close to blackmail, frankly, for your viewers at home. And I do think there is a point at which it probably should have been done before, where we just say, I'm sorry, this is the United Kingdom of Great Britain, Northern Ireland. We cannot accept those dictated terms.
Okay, it feels like we are funneling fast on our route towards Prime Minister Boris Johnson. And so I'd just like to pause and just talk about him. Because in 2008, Boris Johnson did something pretty extraordinary. He won over the Labour-leaning city of London to become mayor. He won a huge number of Labour voters. I mean, people called him a Heineken Tory because he reached parts of the electorate that others couldn't.
Heineken is the only beer able to do this because it refreshes the parts other beers cannot reach.
What made him so popular?
Well, partly his opponent was Ken Livingstone, who I think was a busted flush by then and was incredibly unpopular in the sort of outer suburbs of London. But it's true that Boris Johnson at that point seemed a very much a socially liberal person, pro-immigration.
The new mayor of London, Boris Johnson.
It is vital for a mayor of London to bring people together and to unite them and to serve every community in London impartially.
Very aware about the environment.
What good do trees do? They're wonderful for the psychological benefits they bring. They also, on average, cool the streets they're in by as much as 10 or 15%. They generally cheer people up.
Pretty relaxed about public spending and seemed to be outside the mainstream of the Conservative Party. Didn't seem to be a politician. He was someone you could like, someone you wanted to share a drink with, and had that sense of humour about life and about politics itself. He didn't take himself too seriously, but the metaphor was always that he was the kind of person who could light up a room.
He was seen as pretty authentic. I mean, the only politician who could get stuck on a zip wire.
Get me a ladder. Can you get me a rope? Get me a rope, okay?
And see his poll ratings increase. He won over Labour and UKIP voters. And then in 2016, he had a very difficult decision to make. I mean, as you say, he'd been in charge of a liberal, multicultural city. But he'd also been critical of the EU as a journalist and since then, with stories about bendy bananas.
On bananas, how many directives do you think there are from the European Union on bananas? There are four. Do we need them? Do we need to be told that you cannot have, you know, abnormal curvature of your bananas?
Was it obvious which way he would swing?
No, I don't think it was. I mean, it's been reported many times and it seems to be so redolent of the character of Boris Johnson that he wrote two articles, one in favour of leaving and one in favour of remain. These were two drafts he wrote late at night in his house. He read them back to himself and he thought that one had a cogent argument and the other didn't. And so it was an intellectual process for himself. I think he also sat down and thought, which of these two articles is going to advance my chances of becoming Prime Minister most?
And this is a huge turning point in Boris Johnson's story, because I was talking about how he was seen as this sort of Heineken politician when he was London mayor. But the moment he took sides on the most divisive referendum we've had in decades, he became a Marmite politician.
Love it, hate it, just don't forget it.
Yes, I think it's transformatory, and I don't know whether he understood the nature of the campaign that would have to be fought to win the Brexit referendum. But in the end, he was quite prepared to go along with some pretty anti-migrant rhetoric and write some pretty disgraceful articles in order to win that referendum. And I think it's notable that Michael Gove has said he regrets some of what he wrote and said at the time. I've not seen that kind of note of regret from Boris Johnson. And I think he's doubled down on it rather than retreated.
And then after that referendum, there was, of course, the result, David Cameron leaving, a big Tory fight for who should be leader. Boris Johnson put himself forward and then was betrayed by Michael Gove, and he ended up as Foreign Secretary. What does his time in the Foreign Office tell us about what he might be like as Prime Minister?
Well, when I say a little, I think that says a lot. I think the danger with any Foreign Secretary is that you are simply just turning the pages of history on behalf of history, and you're not actually writing anything onto those pages. And I don't think, if you look at the period when Boris Johnson was Foreign Secretary, he wrote much on the pages of history. Also, he made sort of gaffes, and the one that I think he can't be forgiven for is the mistakes he made about the Iranian-British dual national Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who's in jail in Tehran, and the fact that he implied that she was in fact a journalist who was really working for the UK government, and that was unforgivable.
My remarks on the subject before the Foreign Affairs Select Committee could and should have been clearer, and I acknowledge that the words I used were open to being misinterpreted, and I apologise. I apologise to Mrs. Zaghari Ratcliffe and her family if I have inadvertently caused them any further anguish.
In the Foreign Office, they pleaded with him. They asked him, what do you want to be remembered for? What are the issues, the signature issues you want to be associated with? And they presented him with three or four possibilities, and his brain fused, and he didn't come up with anything.
And what does that tell us about him, that he's all big picture and no detail?
That is the accusation that will be made against him, that he will need a policy unit in number 10, and he will need a chief of staff in number 10 to organise him. I mean, it's not a sin to not be a policy wonk as Prime Minister, but I do actually think one thing we've suffered from in the UK recently is a Prime Minister who is got to grips with policy, and I don't think he's going to be that person.
And the Marmite thing, the idea that he's gone from someone who could cross boundaries and win over voters on the other side to someone who's almost entrenched, he's loved by some people but really disliked by others. That's not just a domestic thing, that's an international thing as well. I mean, his position on Brexit has made him somewhat of an embarrassment on an international stage?
Yes, I think that's one of the things that was really unfair in a way about his appointment as Foreign Secretary was that he is the most hated British politician in Europe. When Donald Tusk talked about
what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit.
Those people who lied their way through the referendum campaign and then ran off. I'm sure he had Boris Johnson at the front of his mind. Macron has called him a liar, and I don't think there are many European politicians who have much time for him. And I think that will have a consequence. It will have a consequence both in our attempts to have a better relationship with Europe once Brexit occurs, and it will, I think, force us closer into the hands of America, with which is he's very naturally associated. So I think if you're looking for a policy direction, I think it will be less Europe, more America.
And it's not just about diplomacy on an international stage. There are things he said in this country that people would find extremely offensive and make them question his character.
I think when the charm wears off, all you're left with is your character. And I think the charm has worn off with Boris Johnson. And I think the character issue is very, very important. I think it's worth quoting a famous or infamous article by Matthew Paris, the Times columnist, who said, incompetence is not funny, policy vacuum is not funny, a careless disregard for the truth is not funny. He is detested by a group of people, who some of whom are close, know him well. But I think he has lost some of the liberal metropolitan classes that used to see something different in him. And I don't think they're going to come back.
And other things that are not funny are comparing women in burqas to letterboxes, or talking about Britain putting a suicide vest on, or before that, talking about watermelon smiles or pickaninnies. I mean, do you think the kind of language he has used will continue to haunt him?
the point I would make is he will just simply cannot do this as Prime Minister. It would just... there's a level at which you can be a Daily Telegraph columnist, even a Conservative MP, even a former Foreign Secretary, and you can say that. But I just don't think you can say it as Prime Minister. But he will argue this is the kind of cut-through you now need. This is the kind of language you now need, look at Donald Trump, to get your base over. And I think he thinks the real problem the Conservative Party face, and I don't see that he's wrong in this, is that it's alienated a working class vote that used to support the Conservative Party, and it's got to win it back. And he's prepared to use a language that no one else is to persuade them that he's a different kind of politician.
So it's really interesting because on the one hand, we see Boris Johnson as the kind of poster boy of Brexit, someone who's driving us towards a hard Brexit, a person who's turned right towards Nigel Farage. And on the other hand, you've painted the picture of him previously as someone who was quite pro or liberal on immigration, somebody who was willing to, you know, see more public spending, someone who cared about the environment. Is it possible that those more liberal instincts take over if he gets the job?
I think it's quite possible that that's what he will try to do, that he will try to present himself once more as the kind of figure that the nation remembers when he was mayor of London. And I think you will see kind of pushes on the environment, pushes on infrastructure spending, on social care, on housing, all the issues that have been pushed to one side in the last 2 years. But you've got to remember Theresa May said the same kind of thing, and then she got swallowed up by Brexit. And I don't see that he can, assuming he became Prime Minister in the autumn, avoid the Brexit swallowing him up as well.
And on Brexit, they can get rid of Theresa May, but the parliamentary mathematics won't change, and the EU position probably won't change. So he's likely to face the same difficulties. If he is Prime Minister, will he call an early general election?
As I understand it, that is the question Conservative MPs are asking him in private, where they have these one-to-one, 20-minute sessions where they talk through what a Johnson premiership might be like. And the first question they ask is, would you call an early general election? Because most Conservative MPs are in fear of that. Whatever kind of bounce Johnson, Boris Johnson might be able to achieve, they are very nervous of a general election. So they would probably prefer him to go back to Brussels and to attempt another negotiation with the new commission, because there will be a new commission in the autumn. And I think the accent in that negotiation would be that a no-deal Brexit is a much more serious option than it was under Theresa May. So that would be the difference. The issue then is, what does he do when the European Union says no to him, there is no further negotiations of any merit or substance? What does he do then? Does he call a referendum? Does he have a no-deal Brexit? Or does he call an election?
Patrick, I've just got one final thing to ask you, which I always want to ask you. I know you're good at predictions, sometimes. What's your prediction for all of this? Where will we be by the end of this year?
I think we will have a Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, and I think he will still be arguing and negotiating with the European Union, and I think he'll be on the cusp of making that decision we've been discussing about an election or a referendum. I've taken you around five different roundabouts with that one.
We'll be back in the car in December then. Patrick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Patrick Winter. This story is moving very quickly. Do follow it all on The Guardian's Politics Live blog, where you can also watch the European election results come in on Sunday night. Coming up, an outpouring of love for Judith Kerr. Now, The Guardian's associate editor and presenter of our books podcast, Claire Armitstead, pays tribute to one of the best-loved authors of children's literature, Judith Kerr, who has died at the age of 95.
Her guilty pleasure was drinking the dregs of yesterday's whiskey. And that's one of my memories of her. I would do these events with her and she had perfect recall, but she always had a little tumbler of whiskey beside her. She's a sort of anti-advertisement for healthy living and old age. So it's a hugely sad moment in terms of us losing one of the greatest, possibly the greatest picture book figure of the last half century. But it's also a life well lived.
The picture books were really the result of having been with my children when they were picture book age.
It just felt like a sort of big bell of doom, Knowling, particularly on the day of the European elections, because Judith Carr is one of our great refugee success stories. The family just had to up and leave everything, and they got out of Germany just before Hitler came to power and made their way across Europe when Judith was very small, arriving in England in 1936. Family was absolutely central to Judith. She always, when you went to interview her, she always talked first and foremost about her father, Alfred Carr, and her husband, Nigel Neal. It was one of those great love stories. She was working in the area of BBC and she went in to have lunch in the canteen and their eyes met across a crowded room. And he got her writing. He always encouraged her and sang her praises to everyone. She was utterly devoted to him. And then her son, Matthew, also went on to become an award-winning novelist. And her daughter, Tacey, works in special effects. And of course, you know, Tiger That Came to Tea was famously written because she was hanging out with Tacey and they were bored and they were just wishing someone would come round and distract them. In that preschool stage when the afternoons stretch endlessly on.
Sophie opened the door and there was a big, furry, stripy tiger.
The thing about the Tiger That Came to Tea is it's been going for so many generations that everybody has a sort of a foundational story about it. And Michael Rosen says it's about the Gestapo. Emily Maitlis was saying it's about the 1960s sexual revolution. I can, from personal experience, very firmly on Judith's behalf, refute the Gestapo theory. She was always very clear it was nothing to do with that. How she framed it, the last time I saw her, was she said it's to do with the joy of unbridled appetite in small children, that sort of being completely swept away by your desire for life. I think she will be remembered for The Tiger That Came to Tea because it is such an important work in terms of the history of illustration in the 20th century. But I also think she will be remembered for When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit. Pink Rabbit was the toy that she left behind. And in the way that children fixate about things, that was her great source of sadness, was that she didn't think to take Pink Rabbit with her. It's entirely haunting and it doesn't age.
Before we get to Zurich and see Papa, we have to cross the frontier between Germany and Switzerland. And she looked at both children in turn. This is very important. When the man comes to look at our passports, I want neither of you to say anything. Papa's name is so well known, we don't want to draw attention to ourselves in any way. So when the man comes, not a word, remember, not a single solitary word.
It is written in a way that doesn't date. It also appeals across age groups. I still find it good to read as an adult. In fact, I first read it as an adult and then I introduced it to my children and rediscovered it. And so she is a testament. She has left two great testaments to the 20th century behind her.
That was Claire Armitstead. And can I add my appreciation to Judith Kerr's wonderful literature, including my favourite, the Mog series. That's it for today. My thanks to Patrick Winter and Claire Armitstead. Today's producers are Rachel Humphreys, India Rackerson, Josh Kelly and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. I hope you have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.